Okay, we're taping, so... Okay. All right, we're taping, so let's continue where we left off. Yes. Yirmiyahu Perek Aleph. Perek Aleph, we're up to Pasuk Yud Aleph. That's where we left off last week. Perek Aleph, Yud Aleph. We're going straight through. Where we leave off is where we start the next week. Page number in the Chumash, just
1192.
Okay. I gave the historical background last week, so I'm not going to review that now. It's all online. Yirmiyahu Perek Aleph Pasuk Yud Aleph is Yirmiyahu's first prophecy. He has been convinced, pretty much against his will. He did not want this job, but he's been convinced by God that he is up for it. He was born for it. God literally tells him that you were set aside from birth to do this. Okay. So now we're reading Vayidvar Hashem Elai Lemor Ma'ata Ro'eh Yirmiyahu. What do you see, Yirmiyahu? What do you see, Yirmiyahu? Okay, now, ostensibly, this is something anyone in this room could see. Okay. Ostensibly, this is something anybody could see. But Yirmiyahu... Yirmiyahu describes what he sees, and he says, "Va'omar makel shoked ani ro'eh." I see a makel, which is a staff, shoked, and it is surrounded or sprouting almonds. Okay, so the psychotherapist shows you a picture of something, and you can identify what it is. I guess the almonds are easy to see. An almond tree grows earlier than all other trees in Israel. In fact, the word shoked is a verb, as the very next pasuk indicates. V'yomer Hashem Elai, hetafti liros. You see well. Ki shoked ani al devari la'asoso. I am going to hasten this thing that I want to do. Now, if you recall last week, the first year of Yirmiyahu, we can identify it very clearly. He says the amount of years he gave prophecy, and the last year he gave prophecy. Just figure it out. 40 years back from that, the end of his prophecy is the year 627 BCE. 627 BCE is a very famous date in that century, famous year. It's the year given by students those who study the history of Assyria. They're called Assyriologists. Assyria has left us a lot of material. And 627 is considered by those scientists to be the end of the Assyrian Empire. 627 is a good year for the Jews, if you consider the downfall of its worst enemy of the last millennia to be good news, right? The 5/6 of our nation, 10 tribes, have been scattered by these people, and their fall should be good news for us. But if we're acting in an immoral fashion, God can exchange the Assyrians with a new kid on the block. So we'll see how that fits into the point of chapter 1 and chapter 2. And the geopolitical situation facing Israel at this time was so precarious that you didn't know who was an enemy and who was a friend. Right? Assyria has been our mortal enemy for over 100 years, and very shortly we're about to turn to those same Assyrians for some assistance against a more vicious enemy, the Babylonians, who are coming up. Okay, right now, Nebuchadnezzar is a young child. His father, Nabopolassar, is the king of Babylonia. And Hashem is saying that I am going to hasten things. There are things about to happen Right? If Nebuchadnezzar takes a fall from his horse, that'll change the whole course of history. But I have plans, and the way our Tanakh is written, the way we understand Jewish history, is that that may happen if you start to act morally. In other words, what's going to happen to the world has to do with the moral behavior of the Israelite nation. It's tantamount to someone coming in 1910 to a communal leader of a meeting of Jewish leaders, and they say, listen, the Jewish people are acting immorally, they're not keeping the Torah, they're not behaving well with each other. Some terrible upheaval is going to happen in Europe in the next 40 years if you don't change your ways. Now, the Jewish population of Europe is a tiny percentage, right? So, too, Hashem tells the prophets that all these changes, all these events, shoked ani al devaru la'asoso. I am going to rush these things from happening. They will happen soon. The world will change dramatically in the coming years, and I am rushing it. Now, I told you before, the almond gets its name because it rushes. It's the first tree that grows in Israel. That's why we sing about it on Tu Bishvat. Right? We're already in February, when you get off the take a taxi from the airport to Yerushalayim, you can smell the almond trees growing already. And that's about where they grow in Israel, near Shalabim, in that area on the way, right near Latrun. That's the main place where almonds grow in Israel. So however, I'd like to besides giving the general picture of why Yirmiyahu's first prophecy is of an almond, Rashi gives a specific picture. I'll read it if you have it. It's on Pasuk Yud Bet in the middle of Rashi. I'll just read it. He says, Umidrash Agada. There is an Agada about why God chose to show Yirmiyahu an almond more than any other fruit as his first vision. And he says, Hashoked hazeh, humishat chanit tato ad gmar bishulo. This almond, from the time it starts what's called chanita, which is where a bud pushes through the branch, right? That's the definition of tree's growth for Tu Bishvat, to make it the next year, right? From the shas chanita, ad gmar bishulo, until it is fully ripened and ready to eat, is esrim ve'echad yom, is 21 days. Kiminyan yamim shebein shiva asar b'tamuz shebo huvka ha'ir letisha bav shebo nisraf habayit. That's a hint of 21 days between the time where the city was breached, the siege on the city they broke through on the 17th of Tammuz. And on the 9th of Av, they burnt the Beit HaMikdash, and that is these 21 days. The problem is that while you see is a pamphlet, Shimon Eider raises the laws of the 3 weeks. That's a misnomer, because the days between Shiva, Sabbat, Tammuz, and Tisha B'Av is 20. If you include those 22 days, it's 22. It's the laws of the 22 days, not the laws of the 3 weeks plus one, it should be. All right, let's not quibble over that. But I want to quibble over something far more dramatic than this. And it really goes down to the core of another introductory point I'd like to make about this book. The introductory point is that the book is profoundly out of order. The book has very little order to it. You can be reading a chapter about Sidkiyahu, which is at the end of Yirmiyahu's tenure of prophecy, and the next chapter he's talking to Yehoyakim, which is in the beginning of his tenure as prophecy. The book has no order whatsoever. He describes the destruction of the temple, and in the next chapter he's in the beginning of his prophecy again. So you really never know where you are in this book. All right? That is done, I would like to suggest to you, with intent. It's trying to show how difficult it was to keep records at that time. Right? Yirmiyahu probably could have had someone put it in order. In fact, we can do it ourselves. In fact, there are books that do. I'm not have patience for that. The book is out of order, and it should stay out of order to indicate to us how difficult it was to write this. Now, I think I mentioned this past 3 weeks, But Rashi is profoundly problematic on two levels. One, Shivosar Batamuz, hold on to your seats, is not a date that appears in the Bible. And guess what? Neither is the ninth of Av. You will not find any single date in the entire Bible that happened on the ninth of Av, and you will not find a single date that happened on the 17th of Tammuz. Now, fast forward to a mission at the end of Maseches Tainis that says, five tragedies happened on the 17th of Tammuz, and five tragedies happened on the 9th of Av. Right? So, of the things that happened on the 17th of Tammuz, it says the siege of Jerusalem was broken. They broke through into the city on the 17th of Tammuz. So the Gemara asks the question, both in the Yerushalmi as well as in the Bavli. Wait a second, it never says the 17th of Tammuz, it says the 9th of Tammuz in the Bible. Open up Sefer Melachim, Sefer Yirmiyahu, Sefer Divrei Yom. And it says that the Babylonians broke through into the city on the 9th of Tammuz. The 17th does not appear. So the Gemara in the Bavli and the Yerushalmi give two drastically different answers to this problem. Why are we fasting on the 17th for something that took place on the 9th? So the Bavli's answer is, anyone? That we're fasting for the second Beis HaMikdash. The breach came through on the second Beis HaMikdash on the 17th, the first Beis HaMikdash on the 9th, and we're only fasting for the second. Now, the 9th of Av is also not a date that appears in the Bible. Here's a bigger problem. In Sefer Melachim, it says they broke through on the 7th of Av. In Sefer Yirmiyahu, it says they broke through on the 10th of Av. The Gemara finds this quite problematic and answers that they broke through to the walls of the old city on the 7th, pillaged for 3 days, set the temple to fire at the end of the 9th of Av, and it burnt to the ground on the 10th. And we fast for when they set it to fire, not when it burned. Okay? So, the second temple was on the 9th of Av itself. Okay, so that's the Bavli's answer. The Yerushalmi, however, gives a different answer. The Yerushalmi agrees with the Tisha B'Av Cheshbon, the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th. But with respect to the 17th of Tammuz, it says Yirmiyahu was wrong. He got the day wrong. And prove to me that Rashi agrees with this. Because Yirmiyahu is Bais Rishon, not Bais Sheni. The almond doesn't take 30 days to sprout. According to Rashi, according to the Gemara in the Talmud Bavli, what does the almond have to do with the 3 weeks?
Yeah, but according to your reasoning, it should be 21 days, according to Rashi, not 22, so maybe Rashi...
Yeah, well, that's not quibble
yeah,
over
but
a
that,
day.
That, I mean, how you... You know,
that's what we say, the laws of the 3 weeks. I'm not going to call Shimon either on that. But anyway, I agree with you. It's an issue. But by the way, there's a student of Rashi who's quoted by the Tur as to describe minhagim of denying ourselves from certain pleasures in the summertime for 3 weeks, right? And the student of Rashi, his name is Rav Sadia, not Sadia Gaon, Rav Sadia of Narbonne. And he says that we deny ourselves for 3 weeks because of what's written in Daniel. Daniel says in chapter 9, I, Daniel, denied myself from fine bread and meat and wine for 3 weeks.
That's from Daniel.
Right? So now Daniel is also by his Rishon. This Sadia of Narbonne, who thinks that this is the source of denying ourselves for 3 weeks of pleasures of certain whatever it is in the summertime, right, is from Daniel, must agree with this also, because Daniel was also Bais Rishon. Is everyone following this? Now, mind you, most commentaries to Daniel say that this has nothing to do with summertime, that the pshat of 3 weeks is 21 years he didn't eat meat, and it has nothing to do with the time in the summer when these tragedies happened, that he even says the day when he started eating meat again, and it's in Nisan. So, there are those who bring proofs, and the proofs are good, that Daniel is not talking about a summertime denial. But what we do see is that there seems to be an Ashkenazic strand that goes along with the Yerushalmi. And let me just tell you one amazing, amazing modern-day leader who seems to also agree with the Yerushalmi. Do you know that, remember 1981 when Israel bombed a nuclear reactor in Iraq?
Yes.
Right? Oh, Sirach, right? Okay. So Saddam Hussein is renamed that city, and I have it I have it on maps. If anyone wants to see it, I think an American soldier who served in the more recent Iraq war, who saw that. He showed me that they call it this. In fact, I saw it quoted in a scholarly journal from Iraq, that there is a city in Iraq where they put this bomb, nuclear reactor. They named it 17 Tammuz. Why? Because he wanted to use the reactor to break through the walls of Jerusalem like Nebuchadnezzar did. So he called the reactor 17 Tammuz.
Wow.
Right? So you know that Saddam Hussein took every picture. There's some multi-million dollar pictures, like half the size of this room, of Nebuchadnezzar in museums in Babylonia, in Iraq, where he cut out the face of Nebuchadnezzar and put his face in there. Every picture, every painting of Nebuchadnezzar that's in every you know, the Seven Hanging Gardens or whatever, he put his face. He wanted to be the modern day Nebuchadnezzar. So you would think Iraq is Bavel, right? So he should paskin like the Talmud Bavli, that 17th Tammuz is by his Sheni, right? He wanted to take the place of Nebuchadnezzar, so he should have called it 9 Tammuz if he was a Chacham, right? Instead, he called it 17 Tammuz. 17 Tammuz is by his Sheni. A Roman emperor should, a Roman leader, an Italian leader should call it 17 Tammuz. You know what I'm saying? But Israel knew what it was doing when it bombed the reactor, because that was his express goal, to do what Nebuchadnezzar did in Jerusalem with this reactor. Yes?
Isn't one of the reasons that we may pass on specifically the night above because of the Meraglim and because it took place on that night?
No one mentions that now, but B'nai Nechanami, some of the keynotes that we say, make some passing reference to that. Yeah, it's the same Mishnah. Okay, anyway, so this I submit to you is Rashi siding with the Yerushalmi. Otherwise, what does this have to do with Bayis Rishon? Bayis Rishon should have been a full month, the 9th of Tammuz to the 9th of Av. I bring this home to you because it underscores the issue you will find when we get to some historical chapters in this book. Okay. Let's go on. Vayidbar Hashem Elai Shenis Lemor. This is the third time God is talking to Yirmiyahu, but it's the second vision. And he says, Ma Taroeh, Va'omar, Sir Nafuach ani ro'eh u'panav mipnei tzafona. I see a seer, a cauldron. Now, what do you think Nafuach means? What is Nafuach? Do we have an English translation that could help us here? What's a Nafuach? Bubbling pot. Swollen pot. You have boiling pot. Okay, Rabbanel disagrees with that, because he says that the word bubbling in Tanakh is Sir Nofeach. Sir Nofeach. A bubbling pot, I'm sorry, nafuach, may come from a similar shorish, but he thinks it's from the pasuk in last week's Torah portion, vayipach ba'apav nishmas chayim. God breathed into Adam's nostrils. So sir nafuach, according to Abravanel, means that you're taking bellows and you're blowing on the bottom of the pot. Now there's thematically a very big difference between the two. According to the traditional English translations that you have here, it means that this pot is already bubbling. According to Abravanel's reading, no, the bubbling is not, God is in a rush to make things happen, but the rush is just starting the fire. The fire is not bubbling yet. And this really fits the time period. If this is an early Nevuah, there's no reason to think otherwise, it's his first visions, then I know you're going to say, how do you know that this isn't much later? This still, it's hard to fathom that this is his original, but he's still standing before God the very first time that he is, it's probably the same day when he said, I don't want to be a Navi, right? So the, plus, look at the answer that God gives him. From the north shall be opened up new evil. I say it's new evil because evil has always come from the north. Where do you think Assyria is? It's to the north. Where's Aram? It's to the north. Right? All right, there's been some bad stuff from Egypt from the south, but the bad stuff happening for the last 200 years has all come from the north. So he says, Tipotach, there's going to be a Pticha, an opening to the north of something evil that is coming upon you. Okay? And that's this cauldron that is just being ignited. They're blowing bellows to nafuach, to blow a new fire, because you might think things are running very well for you with the fall of Assyria. It's not so well. There's a new kid on the block.
Iniquity?
Sorry, what?
The bellows of iniquity?
Oh, it could be.
Or is it the bellows is God pumping the bellows?
I can suffer either of those. Neither of those are both.
That's a great name for a book.
Yeah, probably is. Okay, I think it's written by Saul Bellows. Okay, so Hashem says, "Ki hineni korei lechol mishpachos mamlechos tzafon anum Hashem, uvov nasnu ish kiso pesach sharei Yerushalayim v'kol chom osea seviv v'kol arei Yehuda." This is no chiddush, this pasuk. Hashem says, "I'm going to call all the families of the north." Now, it's up that I don't know if Yirmiyahu can even fathom that. That means it means Babylonia, it means Rome, it means Greece, it means Persia. You know, he's calling upon a series of nations. He goes all the nations to the north. All right? But for the time being, that's we'll call that Bavel. All right? And they are going to set up in the gates of Yerushalayim. They're going to make, you know, take over. Now, this has been already predicted twice earlier. I should say twice as like a fait accompli. During the reign of Chizkiyahu, when he was sick, he was cured from his sickness and added 15 years to his life, and he entertained some Babylonian guests and showed them all his treasures. God told him, in a short time, their descendants will carry off all those treasures. So it's as if, though, I mean, what did he say? I mean, I guess inherent in that kind of prophecy is if there is no drastic change in the morality of the people. Two, Chizkiyahu's son, Menashe, was so evil that wrapping up his life, says Malachim Bet, and because of all the trespasses of Menashe and all the blood he spilled and all the idolatry, etc., etc., God decreed that Jerusalem shall be destroyed. Really? So what's Yirmiyahu doing 40 years later trying to convince the people to do tshuva? Right? Okay, so the answer is, this is how I'd like to say how Hashem works, especially since there are some promises that Yirmiyahu makes in this book for some bad things that just don't happen. I told you too, he promised, he says by an oath of God, write this man, Jehoiachin, childless. He will never have any descendant on my throne. And not only did he have a child, that child served on God's throne. Then he says, the people of this terrible city, Anatot, will never return when the 70-year exile is over. And Nehemiah lists 123 people from that town that returned. So what do we do with this? So the answer is that no prophecy is totally undone. It's totally a fait accompli. What is assumed in every prophecy, even Yonah's that said, "Oh, der boim yom benin ben epoches," in 40 days this city will be overturned, unless of course you do tshuva, right? And, or let's say overturn the city in tshuva, turn over a new leaf, right? With the pechet to tshuva, right? So Rashi writes that's what Yonah feared. For instance, Micha, the prophet, 150 years before Yirmiyahu, said these words: "Zion sodete choresh v'Yerushalayim yim tiyeva harabayis labamos yar." He predicted this place is going to be one day be plowed like a field. That's what Rabbi Akiva spoke about when he was at the end of Makos.
The boxes.
So. When Yirmiyahu said the same thing, they wanted to kill him for it. And they said, "Don't kill him. Someone already said this 150 years ago. Did they kill that man? No, they did tshuva. So we should listen to him." So if I was a devil's advocate and I really wanted to kill Yirmiyahu, I would have said, "Yeah, Yirmiyahu was also lying. They should have killed him too. See, it wasn't destroyed then. It's not going to be destroyed now. He made them change for nothing, and then Yirmiyahu is asking us to do the same." Right, if someone had said that, they would have killed Yirmiyahu. Right, but Baruch Hashem didn't say it. But the point I'm making is that inherent in every prophecy is that open door, just a little slight open door. And sometimes the people take it. Let me give you an example in parenting skills, because if you really know your the full Tanakh and the full scope, especially of this book, but many others, then it helps in parenting skills also. Let me explain. Let's say you have a child who loves to go to a particular event once a year. Let's talk about, say it's a boy who gets, around the time of his birthday, tickets to a Ranger game where he gets to sit right at the penalty box. And he talks to the guys who got off on a penalty. He gets to talk to them for a minute. You know, they have to sit in the box for 2 minutes, 5 minutes. And he loves it. He goes, waits the whole year for this. And then let's say it's in March. All right? So in that year, in December, he does something really terrible. He throws a snowball at the teacher and hits the teacher in the back of the head. So the parents say, no, they forget it. This year, nada. You are not going to that game, and then they take away a couple of other privileges, right? So the kid gets depressed and melancholy. Oh my goodness, I start looking forward to that already in April for the next March. You know, so how, what am I going to do? Right? So a good parent might say, listen, I know how much you look forward to this, but what you did was so bad. Let me just tell you this. I'm not going to be made a sucker, but if you are so good and everything is, I'm going to make him turn that negative into a positive. Your teacher is going to put you on probation, and I'm not going to be a sucker, because you do something like that again, forget it, you're out of there, right? You're on probation right now, so just you know, you want to be so good. Let's see if you can turn this into a positive. So he gets better and better and better and better, and by the time it's the day of the event, he is so good and he stays good and he turned it into a positive. But if you just tell him categorically, forget it, December, you're out. No amount of pleading can change my mind.
Right.
So HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, he's the biggest sucker for us. For us, I'm saying. He keeps on forgiving us when he shouldn't, because he loves us so much, like a little child, you know.
Like, unless you send your shippers a great battle.
Yeah.
Comes in, you have some time to
reverse it. Right. Even you see that the prophets take oaths. Yirmiyahu lift up his right hand and said, I lift up my hand, I swear that this is what's going to happen to Jehoiachin, and it doesn't happen. Okay? All right, so this is a tangent to Pasuk Tes Vav, where he says, a nation from the north is going to set up shop here and just call this place his own. And that's what Hashem told Chizkiyahu, and that's what Hashem said in the narrative about Menashe. Right? Could that have been avoided? It must be. It must be. Otherwise, what's the point of this book?
Right.
He's going to tell them so many times in the early stages, do tshuva and you know, change your ways, and we can avoid this whole problem that seems to be inevitable. Okay, Tesayin 16. V'dibarati mishpatai osam al kol ra'osam asher azavuni v'yikatru le'luhim achirim v'yishtachavu l'maseh yedahem. So, you know, the biggest problem in this book seems to be immorality, but there's also idolatry. Look what's going on here. We will see how bad that idolatry became. In chapter 7, he will describe worship of the child-killing idolatries in Israel.
Child-killing?
Yes.
Explicitly?
Yes. The where they have to beat the drums so you don't hear the kids screaming. You know? Right?
How old would the children be?
Usually newborn, but still, they, you know, we even describes where it was done, how it was done.
Gay
Ben Hinnom, yeah. He says, you know, the Babylonians are going to come here, they're going to rename the place, you kill your children here, the Babylonians will come and kill a lot more people here. Why are you doing this? Just to be like the nations? All right, but you know what? You don't want to take my commands? Good, you'll take their commands. Let's see how you like that. And you won't speak their language either. Va'ata te'ezor masnecha. So here you have your job. Go for it. You're not even going to get paid. Te'ezor masnecha means gird your loins, which means, you know, it's a lotion of zrizus, of enthusiasm. V'kamta, v'dibarta. You see, get up and go. Who knows what enthusiasm he must have had as a result of this conversation. He's talking to God. God touched his lips. Remember where we ended up last week? Barta aleihem is kol hasher nochi atzaveka. Al techas mipneihem penachitcha lifneihem. Can I have an English translation? What do you have at the end of 17? Jones, can you read it? The end of verse 17, where it says, do not fear.
Do not be frightened of them, lest I let you be broken before them.
Okay, that is the reading of Radak. And it's therefore a play on words. The play on words is in Hebrew between techat, which means to be frightened, and achitcha, which means to be broken. It's the same word. Right? Okay, so Yirmiyahu is dealing with a pun. If you fear them, you'll be broken before them. Okay, got it? Does everyone have an English translation that reads like that?
No, this one is different.
What do you have there?
It says, do not tremble before them, lest I cause you dismay before them.
Okay, it's a different rendition of the word, but it's the same theme. But I want to tell you that Rav Yosef Kara says something amazing of how to read this. He says that the word pen does not cut the phrase in half. In other words, don't fear them, lest I cut you down before them. In other words, if you fear them, I will cut you down. You'll be cut down before them if you fear them. Be firm and strong, right? Rav Yosef Kara says, why would God talk to him on his first prophet's first day on the job this way? Right? If you fear them, you're dead. And he talks to him that way. Instead, although the word pen is a little strange in this usage, but it is used, it's used in English this way. He says it's a continuum. Read it, try to read this as one phrase. Can you do it in the Hebrew? Al techat mipneihem pen achitcha lifneihem. Don't fear lest I cut you down before them. You see, read it as a continuum. Read it as a ongoing phrase. Do not fear them that I would cut you down before them. All right? This is Rav Yosef Kara. It's not the pshat. All right? He says... I say it's in once it happens three or four times, but there is a strand of parshanot usually not accepted by the French, and Kara is a Rashi student, but certainly very popular amongst the Spanish, that once a phrase can be used even once this way anywhere in the Bible, it's fair game anywhere else. Right? But have you ever heard it used that way in English? Do not fear lest I cut you down before them. I've heard you know. Not fear, lest I cut you down before them. That's Radak. When Kara reads it, do not fear lest I cut you down before them. You're right, I would prefer Asher there. Al techat mipneim Asher, or
Shema.
But Shema is not a... Shema is a Talmudic word, not a biblical word. Okay. Yeah, it means rush to it, rush to the next word. You know? Yeah, I like that, because if it was a separate phrase, pen should stand by itself. It should have its own trup. Yeah. Like, okay. Look at all these nice terminologies he's giving for him. You would be like a fortified city, like a wall of iron, like gates of brass. Al kol ha'aretz. Right? God is giving him an additional pep talk. Why you should not be afraid of this mission. Right? Because you will talk to kings, you will talk to officers, you will talk to kohanim, and you will talk to the masses of people. This is breaking new ground. There were prophets who spoke it, and you know, Hoshea and Amos, for instance. They rarely overlapped. Amos talked to the Am Ha'aretz, Hoshea talked to the Kohanim, the Sarim, and the Malachim. Right? Yirmiyahu is all the prophets together. Because usually they shared certain duties between, you know, to go to different groups. Yirmiyahu himself is a Kohen, so it's no surprise that he would talk to the Kohanim. Right. So v'nil chamu elecha, as you can imagine, Yirmiyahu, I'm not telling you a chiddush. They will not accept this so readily. Right. With the irony, we talked about this over this at the end of the summer. The most successful prophet of the entire Bible is the one who sets out to fail. Yonah. Right.
He's the only one to talk to non-Jews.
All right, so he explained it, that his failure is what made him his desire to fail is what made him a success. It's like, you know, reverse psychology, right? So, I think they say it's much more common for students to get every answer right on the SAT than every answer wrong on the SAT. In fact, if someone would get every answer wrong on the SAT, they're quite sure that he is purposely doing so. No doubt. Anyway, if someone's he's trying to fail, and he's the one that's successful. All right, so they will fight against you, Yirmiyahu, v'lo yichlulach, but they will not succeed. That's a promise that goes a long way in this book. Yirmiyahu looks up at God sometimes as, I know God, they're not killing me, but they're doing everything short of that, for goodness sakes. You know, I appreciate that, Yasser Yisrani Yov, Alamovis Lonis Anoni. You know, they're doing a good job of they did everything. You see Prokhorov, where they punch him, where they beat him, where they kick him, where they abuse him. He's the actor, he's an object of derision. They throw him in the stocks, they throw him in pits, they throw him in mud up to his neck, they throw him head down into pits. This is all, I'm not telling you, Medrash, this is all in Prokhorov in this book. Right? Okay. But lo yichlu lach ki yitcha aninu Hashem lahatzilecha. I will always save you. The next week's Haftorah just continues. Vayidvar Hashem elai lemor. I believe this is actually the beginning of the next one, or this could the end of the first one.
Yeah,
it's the end of the first one.
The end of the first.
Right. Haloch v'karasala be'oznei Yerushalayim lemor. Ko amar Hashem, zochartil lo chesed nurayich, abas klu losayich, lechtecha charay b'midbar b'eretz lo zura. So Israel started to become like husband and wife. You see, Avas klulo sayach, like a kala. I loved you like a kala. We stood together under the chuppah at Har Sinai. Now, the difference between Israel as a child in Shmos, they start off b'ni b'chori Israel. You're like a son, and you can't change the relationship with a son. You can be estranged, but you can't be unsunned, right? But you can be unspoused. Right, so Hashem is saying in chapter 2, what a beautiful relationship we had. Now, that relationship didn't last so wonderful. I mean, she committed adultery right under the chuppah there, right? But you know what? It was still, lechtecha charay b'midbar b'eretz lo zrua. You did follow me into the desert, right? Rashi here says that, because it says, v'gam tseida lo asu lahem. Where does it say that, by? The gam tseida lo asu lahem. No, that's right in bold. To explain that why we eat matzahs, because they just went off with it, just this the sweat of their shoulders made the bread rise a little more, and something about the shikmosam, right? So they left with nothing more than with no tseida besides that matzah. So Rashi here says, what an amazing thing. You trust God so profoundly as to go out there without anything but that. Sephorno in his Perush al HaTorah says that in Bishalach, one of the first places they stopped was a place that had 70 palm trees. Sound familiar, right? It's 70 palm trees and 70 Mayanot, Einot Mayan, springs. So you'd think they'd want to stay there a little while, right? And it says as soon as they got there, Vayisu Me'ilim. So right away they left. So there, Sforno says, you'd think they'd want to stay. So this is what Yirmiyahu meant when he said, Lechtecha charay b'amidbar. Tell me where to go, I'll go.
When the children of Israel went into the desert, can it be that they went there also because it was harder for the Egyptians to get them? If they would have went straight to Eretz Israel, perhaps the Egyptian king would have gone after them to bring them back to Egypt?
So there is a pasuk in the beginning of Bishalach that explains, they didn't pass through the Plishtim.
No, that they stayed there 40 years.
Right, so Rashi gives something that resembles what you just said. That ki karov hu means, not although it was close, but because it was close, he didn't go that way. But because it had to do with going back to Egypt. But anyway, we have to give a whole shiur about why Bnei Israel had to spend time in the desert,
and
why didn't God just take them right on those eagle's wings straight to Israel? But here, I think it doesn't take much ingenuity to interpret that lechtecha charay b'midbar has a few manifestations in the beginning of of our trek into the desert, in Parshas Bo as well as in Bishalach. Okay, so he says, Kodesh Yisrael Lashem Reishis Tevuaso. Israel is holy unto God. Now, what is Reishis Tevua? What do you call that in the Torah?
You mean that's the first fruit.
Truma is called Reishis Tevua. Okay. Yes, Truma. Bikurim is I mean, it's also a type of Reishis, no doubt, because Bikurim is a type of Truma, but it's the food of Kohanim. And the punishment for someone who shouldn't be eating it, who eats it, is called Misa Bidei Shamayim, death at the hands of God. So that's what he's saying here. Listen, you will always be my truma. And if anybody eats you who shouldn't eat you, right? Now, only people who can ever eat you are the people who I give over to eat you. Right? Okay? Ra'at tavo aleihem nu Hashem. Whoever harms you, evil shall always come to them. And you know, it's been that way throughout history, except for Christians and Muslims. And, you know, Ruth Wissey, I think that's how she pronounces her last name, W-I-S-S-E, she's head of the Yiddish department at Harvard. She wrote a book about this, saying that Jews always viewed their historical, mishaps through the lens of morality, because that's what their prophets say. Right? If there was an earthquake in Israel, Amos explains to us exactly why that's happened, and that happens. Not because of tectonic plates underneath the earth's mantle that rub against each other. No, because of an immoral act committed by the king. Right? So, and even the narratives of Devarim Yomim say so. So the events of history happened because of immorality, and therefore we can always change that by being moral. Right? We didn't lose the temple because of an inordinate, powerful force of Romans overcame a fractious Israelite opposition. That's not why we lost the Beis Hamikdash. We lost the Beis Hamikdash because of sinus chinam, because of baseless hatred. Right? So, if you are chained to a slave ship by these wicked, horrific Assyrians and you're driven out of your land, you know that you will outlast these horrible slave owners and these horrible conquerors, because they're immoral and you're not. But when those who conquered us decided, you know what? Let's get a Bible. Let's get morality. Let's pick up on their idea. So that means they will succeed. Now, at times when they became immoral, they ran into trouble too. But here we are, as a testament to God's promise that we will always be His truma. And here's another interesting, just a world history lesson, is that whenever Jews have it bad, the whole world is suffering. Whenever the Jews have it good, the world is doing well. Right? So it's time that the world gets on with this. Right? There's actually a Protestant minister, his name is Kenneth Rawson, who travels the world trying to convince, he made a film proving this. It's an hour-long film, I have it here in the office. He showed it here once, about 10 years ago, if anyone remembers. And he travels the world, and when you ask him in the question-answer period afterwards, he goes, "What? So if you think this about Jews, why don't you just convert?" He said, "I would in a second. It's just that I can do more good as a Protestant minister than as a Jew, in terms of pressing forth this message." He just thinks, I think it's good for the world.
Yeah.
Right? He considers himself a Noahide. He wouldn't take a cent. I tried to at least pay him for his expenses. He came in from Virginia.
Wow.
It's just really amazing. Okay, so Shimud v'Hashem beis Yaakov v'chomish v'chos beis Yisrael kol amar Hashem ma matzu avoseichem biyovel ki rachaku me'alai. What a tragic figure God is here. What have I done? Can you picture like an Alta Baba who's speaking to her son who never writes home and never calls? You know, I see you spending so much time on Narishkeit and
beyond the
house. No, the second week. Go, continue.
I'll just continue. Oh.
Just continues to the next week.
Yeah, I see that. Okay.
So what have I done? I can't write home a little bit. You can't wear tefillin. You can't put on a little pair of tzitzis. Come on. All right. So So he says, Ma matzu avoseichem. This is going on for generations. Now, I can tell you, I can put out the bright lights. God, compared to the other Avodah Zarah, you know what you are? Boring. Right? I don't mean to be chas v'shalom, but if you would compare what other Avodah Zarahs are doing, forget about, I mean, the idiocy of killing your child, but that was a popular thing back then. But the horrific Avodah Zarah with Gilui Arayos and Shvichus Damim, and especially the Gilui Arayos, Yodim Ha'yu Yisrael Shein Mamesh B'Avodah Zarah, the Jews knew that Avodah Zarah was nonsense. Ela Lahatirim Gilui Arayos B'Farhesia. It was a heter for not just as a show, but it was participatory, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So
it was in Egypt.
It was all over. All right, so they knew how to get the young people to the temples, right? But it, you see, religion then is like what a lot of things are turning into now. It's for the feel good, it's for the moment, and it's not for some obligation that leads to continuity and coming back. And you just come back for as long until whatever disease is transmitted at this service comes and gets you, right? Remember what Rashi wrote in last week's parasha? He says the thing that did in the world was chamas. Was violence, was gezel. But when there is hashchosa, which is gilui arayos, which is sexual licentiousness, Rashi brings down this long Greek word, andromaslia, comes to the world. Right? Which is whatever diseases are transmitted with all that's going on. Everyone's sleeping with each other.
Hebrew, you
it's a long word, under maslia, something under.
Before that, hashfat.
Vatishoches, that's the word in the Torah.
Oh.
Hashchosa, vatishoches haaretz.
Okay.
Kishchis kobasar. So it's just God telling us, listen, I don't mean for that. It's not me sending you a whammy. No, I want you to live.
It's
but those things, those
right.
The consequence. There are consequences to your actions. What does a parent tell a child who wants them to learn how to cross the street? They tell them, if you cross the street when that light is that color, a car will hit you. Not a car won't, but may hit you. A car will hit you. So what does the child do? The child goes out 4 or 5 times when it's red, 7 or 8 times when it's red, and he sees nothing happened to me. I keep crossing. What Yirmiyahu is going to call shortly, Meshuva Nitzachas. Meshuva Nitzachas. Rebellious and successful. Now, does the child look every time he crosses the light when it's red, he's doing so to be rebellious? No, he just wants to get the other side. He doesn't want to wait for the light. But the father is just telling him, listen, this is the way of the world. Something is going to catch up to you. Right? Now, is it also possible that one time a person decides to wait at the corner, and wait for the light to turn, and someone makes a sharp right turn and runs him over while he's waiting at the corner?
Much rare.
That's happened too.
Much rare.
And if he had crossed it with the red, he would have been on the other side of the street at the time, alive, right? So yes, but you know what? Why play the percentages, right? So against the percentages, I'm saying. So that's the thing. God speaks to us in the Torah and in Yirmiyahu in certain absolutes about things that will happen because those not because I want them to happen. Those things are waiting to happen. They're likely to happen. Must they happen? No. No, they don't. They're not must. Nadu Derech Hashem Tzalecha. Some wicked people thrive very well. Right?
Okay. Possibility and probability.
Okay, yeah. That's we have to work that through with our prophecies. All right? So he says, Vayelchu Acharei HaHevel VaYehebalu. Isn't that amazing? They went after Hevel to the point that
they became
Hevel. This is great, amazing medrash about Avram Avinu tending his father's Avodah Zarah shop. Terach had an idol store, right? And there are all kinds of stories in the medrash about how Avram tended to the shop while his father was away, right? And in one medrash, he has all kinds of people coming to put on order a certain idol that mirrors them. this big strong guy wants her. Give me a big, big strong idol. This little lady comes in and says, come on, sign a little love. So you see, the people are trying to create their God in their own image. Right? But it's also, we become like the things we pursue. Right? And you know, that you might think that these pursuits are worthwhile now, but try doing them for the rest of eternity. So we'll become like our pursuits. And so I'm sure there are other midrashim like that you know about Avraham. The most famous one, I think, is where he smashes all of them and he puts an axe in the hand of one of them. And when his father comes home and back to the store and he sees all his idols are smashed, he goes, what happened here? He goes, that one over there, he took care of all. I couldn't stop him. He was stronger than I am. He goes, don't be stupid. He can't do that yet, really? And then you worship him? So look, they weren't stupid to think that these graven images were meant to stand in. They were images that represented a god. And I think, if you excuse me, Christians do that all the time. They have a necklace. They have they hold somebody a picture and they kiss it. And right, so they represent, you know, the Creator with something. Okay, so I'm sorry. Like you like to end on a high note, but just be careful, because if we pursue Hevel to too great an extent, we will become Hevel. All right, Shmuel David Lutzato suggests that the second child of Adam and Eve had another name, and they called him. The Bible calls him Hevel because of the ending that he had, but that there's no way how would the parents are going to name their child Hevel. Right? Now Hevel also means breath. Hevel shebefihem. Hevel means breath, because when you breathe, Hevel shebefihem, it just goes into nothingness. It's Hevel. I call Hevel. So that's his name, Nebuch. All right. So you go after Hevel, you'll become Hevel, and it's an interesting verb. Vayehebalu, I Heveled. I became Hevel. All right. Okay, we'll continue with Mitzvah Shem with Perek Beis Pasuk Vav next time.